Good morning. My name is Susan, and today I'll be reading from the BBC World News. It's May 29th, 2026. This article was posted 25 minutes ago. 8 students arrested in Kenya after suspected deadly school arson attack. 8 students alleged to have been involved in a suspected arson attack at a Kenyan girls' school that killed 16 pupils have been arrested, police say. The fire in the early hours of Thursday morning at the Utumishi Girls Academy in Gilgil, about 120 kilometers or 77 miles northwest of capital city Nairobi, tore through the upper floor of a dormitory which had 135 bunk beds. After interviews with students and staff and a forensic review of CCTV, 8 pupils at the school were identified as persons of interest in connection with the planning and the execution of the fire, the National Police Service said in a statement. Investigations are continuing into the exact cause of the blaze. Police said the students were detained for questioning after being traced to their homes and brought back to the school, while others who had remained in the area were also tracked down and detained. The 8 were among 30 students who were initially recalled to the school by detectives investigating the deadly fire. Regarding the aftermath of the fire, Education Minister Julius Ogamba said preliminary findings indicated that there had been multiple breaches of safety measures at the school, including overcrowding in dormitories and a locked exit door. Quote, "In particular, there was congestion in the dormitory and one exit door was locked, contrary to the prescribed safety requirements," end quote, he said. He dissolved the school's board of management and ordered action against the head teacher. The minister said appropriate disciplinary and legal steps would be taken against anyone found to have failed in their duties. And investigators continue their work. Sorrowful scenes unfolded at the school as parents and relatives broke down while waiting for updates about their loved ones. Security was heightened around the institution as crowds gathered demanding swift action and accountability over the incident. Quote, "I arrived at the school at 7 a.m. and 3 hours later, I don't have any information," Najuki Nithimba, who is looking for his niece, told the BBC on Friday morning. Some officers came from the school and asked the parents to group themselves into 3 groups. Group 1 is for parents whose children have been arrested in relation to the incident. Group 2, parents whose children have died, and group 3 of parents who don't know where their children are. "I handed them my niece's name, and I am now waiting to be told information about her." Samuel Githua came to the school to look for his sister. "I don't know where my sister is. We've been told some children are in hospital, some in the mortuary. Our mother died when we were young, so I have taken care of her like a father and a mother. She has been my child," he added. As well as the fatalities, the fire resulted in injuries to 79 pupils, some as a result of jumping from the first floor. 7 of those injured were transferred to Nairobi on Thursday for specialized medical care, while the rest have been treated and discharged. The bodies of those who have died have been taken to the nearby mortuary for preservation and DNA identification. Kenya has had a long history of school fires. Just 2 years ago, at least 21 people died in a dormitory fire in central Kenya. Many fires reported in boarding schools have been the result of arson, with disgruntled pupils angry about the discipline and the living conditions and accused of being responsible, while others were caused by accident. Overcrowding in dormitories and the failure to follow safety guidelines, such as keeping exits clear, windows unlocked, have frequently been blamed for the high number of casualties. Just 2 days ago, this was reported to the BBC. What is Ebola and why is stopping the latest outbreak so difficult? An Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo has been declared a public health emergency of international concern by the World Health Organization, or the WHO. The latest outbreak is challenging because it involves a rare species of Ebola for which there is no vaccine, and the epicenter is in an area affected by conflict. But what is Ebola, and what are the symptoms? Ebola is a rare but deadly disease caused by a virus. Ebola viruses normally infect animals, typically fruit bats, but outbreaks among humans can sometimes start when people eat or handle infected animals. It takes 2 to 21 days for symptoms to appear, but they come on suddenly and start like the flu or malaria with fever, headache, and tiredness. As the disease progresses, vomiting, diarrhea develop, and it can lead to organ failure. Some, but not all, patients develop internal and external bleeding. The virus spreads from one person to another by contact with infected bodily fluids, such as blood or vomit. Ebola outbreaks used to be small and contained to remote rural areas. However, urbanization is pushing larger populations closer to the natural reservoirs of Ebola and increasing the risk of transmission. Symptoms may appear 2 to 21 days after contact and get progressively worse. This outbreak is caused by the rare Bundi Bugyo species of Ebola, which has not been seen for over a decade. Named after a district in Uganda where it was first detected, Bundi Bugyo has caused two previous outbreaks, one in 2007 and one in 2012. One study showed that it killed about a third of those infected, far less than the more common Zaire and the Sudan species. Initial blood tests for Ebola in the affected areas were negative, as they were designed to identify the more common species of the disease. There is no approved vaccine for Bundi Bugyo, but experimental ones are in development. It is possible that a vaccine for the Zaire species may offer some protection. There are, though, also no drugs that target this particular virus, making it harder to treat. The WHO has recommended the evaluation under strict protocols of the experimental antiviral drug Obeldesivir, developed during COVID, to see if it's effective in stopping those who've been in contact with Ebola patients from getting sick. A further complication is that the outbreak is taking place in a conflict zone, with 250,000 people displaced from their homes and people moving across porous borders into neighboring countries. Trish Newport from medical charity Doctor Without Borders, who is heavily involved in efforts to tackle the outbreak, told the BBC World Service that territory constantly changed hands between different armed groups, making it difficult for emergency response teams to simply drive to Ebola hotspots. She pointed out that a further problem was bad roads, with a 90-kilometer or 56-mile journey from Bunia City to Mongwalu, one of the two gold mining towns where the majority of cases have been reported, which takes more than 3 hours. Newport added that for some families in Mongwalu, 15 people have died. However, the WHO's declaration of a public health emergency of international concern does not mean we are in the early stages of a COVID-style pandemic. The risk Ebola poses outside Central and East Africa is minimal. The first known case of Ebola was a nurse who developed symptoms on April 24th, which means the virus had been spreading undetected for weeks. The nurse died in Bunia, the capital of eastern DR Congo's Ituri province, according to Congolese Health Minister Samuel Roger Kamba. The victim's body was repatriated to Mongwalu. Kamba said one of the reasons the virus spread so quickly was the number of people exposed to the body during the funeral ceremony. Africa's public health agency, the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, told the BBC World News that funerals were a particular concern, as they also helped spread the disease during previous outbreaks. Africa CDC Director Dr. Jean Kaseya said public health information campaigns were providing information on how to handle funerals and the importance of basic hygiene and sanitation, as well as providing protection measures for health workers. Kamba said there have been delays in reporting Ebola cases because infected communities believe the disease to be witchcraft or a mystical illness, resulting in people seeking treatment from prayer centers and witch doctors rather than going to hospitals. How many Ebola cases have there been reported, and where are they? The WHO chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said he was deeply concerned about the scale and the speed of the epidemic. On May 25th, the WHO said more than 900 cases were suspected in the DR Congo, where at least 220 people were thought to have died from the virus. This death toll included courageous health workers, the Congolese health ministry said. Officials in neighboring Uganda have so far confirmed one death from Ebola, an individual who traveled to the capital city of Kampala from DR Congo. The Ugandan authorities also have confirmed 5 cases. Several of the DR Congo's confirmed cases are in its eastern Ituri province, the epicenter of the outbreak, and the North Kivu province. American doctor Peter Stafford tested positive after treating patients at Nyankunde Hospital in Bunia, where he has worked since 2023. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or the CDC, said he had been evacuated to Germany for treatment and that it was working to evacuate at least six other Americans who have been exposed to the disease. Since the 21st of May, two cases have been confirmed in South Kivu, a province partly controlled by the rebel AFC M23 alliance. These discoveries signaled the outbreak spread from its epicenter, hundreds of kilometers away. The Congolese authorities have reported one death in South Kivu, but it is unclear whether this is an individual who has been suspected or confirmed to have died from Ebola. A case has also been reported in eastern DR Congo's biggest city of Goma. It has a population of about 850,000 people and is also controlled by AFC M23. The Congolese government has ramped up testing and sent health teams to the epicenter with protective equipment. Organizations such as the WHO and Doctors Without Borders have set up treatment centers in all affected areas. The WHO has dedicated $3.9 million to tackling this outbreak, while Africa's CDC has announced $319 million budget. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has pledged an initial $5 million to support the agency's plan. For DR Congo's health authorities, contact tracing has become a major focus. Around 3,600 people have been identified as contacts of infected individuals and are being closely monitored. A toll-free number, 151, has been provided for reporting symptoms, and people are being reminded to avoid contact with bodies of people who died with symptoms or with dead animals. Not eat raw meat, as undercooked food may transmit the virus, and practice social distancing. The AFC M23 group says it has created an Ebola response team to prevent the spread of the disease in the area that it controls. On May 17, spokesman Lawrence Kanyuka said the group had immediately activated response mechanisms in conjunction with health services and local medical facilities. Neither the government nor the rebels have explicitly said whether they are prepared to work together to tackle the outbreak. However, the case in Goma was confirmed by a state-run body, the INRB. Caitlin Brady, the country director for the Danish Refugee Council, is currently in Goma to prepare her organization's response. She says she has been informed by the rebels that they are using contact tracing and all appropriate measures to contain the virus. She told the BBC World Services Newsday program that, quote, a lot of the health officials and healthcare workers stayed and they have continued working, end quote, after rebels seized the city, meaning the capacity to respond has remained. But what about Rwanda and other neighboring countries? What are they doing about the Ebola outbreak? Rwanda has closed its border with the DR Congo, while Uganda has temporarily suspended flights, buses, and all other public transport crossing the border with the DR Congo. Authorities in Uganda have told people to avoid hugging and to avoid shaking hands. President Yoweri Museveni also postponed the Martyrs' Day pilgrimage, a Christian holiday which is held on June 3rd every year, which usually draws thousands of Congolese nationals to join festivities. Several other African countries are tightening borders, border screenings, and bolstering health facilities. The Africa CDC has warned that other countries on the continent, namely Angola, Burundi, the Central African Republic, Ethiopia, Kenya, Rwanda, South Sudan, Tanzania, and Zambia, are all at risk from the outbreak. This next article for BBC World News was posted 2 days ago. Ghana welcomes Pope's apology over Catholic Church's role in slavery. Ghana has welcomed Pope Leo the 14th apology for the Catholic Church's historic role in slavery, describing it as an act of moral courage that was important in the global pursuit of truth, human dignity, and justice. The Pope issued the clearest apology yet for the Church's involvement in legitimizing slavery and its delay in condemning it for centuries. The apology was published on Monday in the Pope's first major teaching document of his papacy, which also focused on the dangers of artificial intelligence, or AI. Ghana was a major hub for the transatlantic slave trade, when millions of people were captured and loaded onto ships, never to return home. Between the 16th and the 19th centuries, between 12 and 15 million Africans were shipped to the Caribbean, with about 2 million dying during the journey. Ghana has long been leading efforts for compensation and apologies from Western nations for the slave trade. The gravest crime against humanity, what does the UN vote on slavery mean? The Western African nation's government said the Pope's recognition of the painful past was an important step towards healing, reconciliation, and a just society. Quote, the apology reinforces the growing global understanding that confronting historical injustices demands truth-telling and moral responsibility as essential foundations for justice and reconciliation, end quote, its statement released on Tuesday said. The Pope's apology was delivered in what is known as encyclical, technically a letter to Catholic bishops, by which over recent decades have been how a pontiff passes on messages to the world. In his papal letter titled Magnifica Humanitas, or Magnificent Humanity, Pope Leo sincerely asked for a pardon in the name of the Church, adding that it was, quote, impossible not to feel deep sorrow when contemplating the immense suffering and humiliation endured by so many, end quote. Leo said church authorities had at times responded to requests of rulers by regulating and legitimizing forms of subjugation, including the enslavement of non-Christians. He also acknowledged that earlier in the Middle Ages, ecclesiastical institutions had their own slaves. This constitutes a wound in Christian memory, he said of the church's record. In April, Pope Leo completed an 11-day, four-day nation of Africa, his first visit to the continent as pontiff, and where he made several forthright remarks, including lashing out at foreigners who exploit Africans' wealth for profit. Ghana said the Pope's acknowledgement of the painful history was significant at a time when the world was having a deeper reflection on the effects of slavery and colonialism. The country successfully pushed for a UN resolution in March, which recognized the enslavement of Africans as the gravest crime against humanity. Submitted by Ghana's President John Mahama and backed by the African Union, it aims to provide a pathway to healing and the payment of reparations. It also seeks to address the enduring consequences of slavery, like inequality and racial discrimination. Ghana, which still has some of the forts that were used for holding captives under inhumane conditions as they waited to be shipped to the Americas by European powers, is due to host a conference in June in order to discuss the next steps following the adoption of the UN resolution. On Tuesday, Human Rights Watch said the Pope's apology marked an important step, but stressed apologies alone were not enough and that real reparative justice needs to go forward. Religious institutions, along with states and corporations that benefited from slavery, should, quote, reckon seriously, end quote, with their histories and take part in reparative efforts, the rights group added. Our next article turns to the arts. Hideous, the controversy over Picasso's most shocking painting. The confrontational painting, Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, has been both widely despised and loved, and over the decades has remained contentious. A century after it was created by Picasso, acclaimed U.S. artist Henry Taylor reinterpreted and challenged the piece, and his version is now at the center of a major exhibition at the Museo Picasso in Paris. In 1907, Pablo Picasso invited a small circle of artists and friends to his studio in Paris. He wanted to show them a painting he had been working on for 6 months. Almost unanimously, the reaction from his peers was shock, horror, and disgust. The French painter Jean Braque reportedly compared the experience to drinking petrol, and Henri Matisse is said to have called the women in it hideous. It wouldn't be shown publicly until 1916, almost a decade later. More than a century on, it has become one of Picasso's most recognizable and controversial works. It has also been reinterpreted by the acclaimed U.S. painter Henry Taylor. His version is currently displayed at a major exhibition at the Musée National Picasso in Paris. And Taylor emphasizes a key point about the early painting. It owes a lot more to African art than Picasso ever liked to admit. The painting Picasso had shown his peers was Les Demoiselles d'Avignon. In 1907, a large oil painting which five nude women in a brothel in Barcelona demand the viewer's attention. Two of the women have mask-like faces. Three stare back at the observer, and all have jagged, disjointed bodies. It marked a sharp turn in Picasso's creative journey and a dramatic departure from the artistic norms of the time. Picasso moved away from emotional, figurative painting toward breaking forms apart and rethinking how space and bodies are shown, said Joanne Schnurek, a curator at the Musée National Picasso, and tells the BBC, quote, "The shift was key to the development of cubism and modern art more broadly," end quote. Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, the Young Ladies of Avignon, was initially named Le Bordel Avignon, the Brothel of Avignon, until 1916 when the title was changed to be less contentious. It is considered a fundamental work in the birth of Cubism, the 20th century art movement known for abandoning traditional, realistic forms of representation in favor of fragmented and geometric shapes. As Picasso did in the Demoiselles, Cubism merged multiple vantage points of an object or a person into a single image. Quote, "Part of what made the reaction so strong is that Picasso didn't change one thing. He changed everything at once," end quote, Schnurek said. Even for artists who were already experimenting with new styles, this felt like a step too far. But Picasso's innovations didn't come out of nowhere. Some of them, it could be argued, came straight from the African continent. Months before creating this painting, Picasso had developed a particular interest in African masks and sculptures, spurred by a small figurine from what is now the Democratic Republic of the Congo that Matisse had purchased in Paris in 1906. Picasso began regularly visiting the African section of the Musée Ethnographique du Trocadéro, creating hundreds of preparatory sketches for his new masterpiece. Quote, "What struck him wasn't how they looked, but how they worked. The faces are simplified, distorted, sometimes quite intense or even unsettling," Schnurek said. He was clearly inspired by this different approach to the human face, which allowed him to move away from naturalism towards something more abstract and confrontational. Despite this work and many others being shaped by his encounters with African art, Picasso was known to have downplayed its influence. He famously said to a critic working on a series of African art for a journal in 1920 that he had, quote, "never heard of it," end quote. Picasso's reluctance to acknowledge the impact of African art on his work while directly benefiting from it later provoked accusations of cultural appropriation. Critics highlight the cultural, religious, and social significance of the objects in that Picasso observed but seemingly ignored, and how this fed into the wider narrative of African art being seen as primitive at the time. Henry Taylor returned to Picasso's iconic painting when visiting Paris for his first European show in 2007. Almost exactly a century after Picasso's first created it, Taylor's version, titled From Congo to the Capital and Black Again, 2007, is now on show at the Musée National Picasso Paris for Henry Taylor, Where Thoughts Provoke. His first major retrospective in Europe, he keeps the basic structure and poses of the five nude women and their two signature masked faces, but the initially white figures are now black, nodding more overtly to African art. Known for exploring black life in the U.S., Taylor reimagines the composition from his own perspective as an artist with a different cultural and social background. Quote, "Taylor's work often centers on people who have historically been underrepresented, giving them presence and individuality," said Snrish. When placed together, Picasso and Taylor's works highlight not just artistic differences, but also broader questions about power, influence, and whose stories are actually being told. But the two works also highlight a possible different attitude towards women. Picasso's historically troubled relationship with the opposite sex has become difficult to separate from his paintings' afterlife. Known for a string of fraught romances, Picasso reportedly told the painter François Gillot that all women are either, quote, goddesses or doormats, end quote, and machines for suffering. To some critics, the violence of the fragmented body feels personal rather than aesthetic. The subject, a group of new women in a brothel, was already provocative, but Picasso removed any softness. In the newer version, while abstracted, their bodies are less disjointed. The result is more powerful than it is aggressive. Taylor's central figure stands with her arms partially behind her back. The short asymmetrical bob she wears shares a likeness with Josephine Baker, a U.S.-French dancer and singer known as the first black woman to become a world-famous superstar. By doing this, the artist brings in questions of identity, race, and representation. Taylor's title, From Congo to the Capital and Black Again, 2007, references Matisse's Congolese figure that sparked Picasso's interest in African art, noting its movement from Africa to Paris. It also refers to the way that Taylor himself made the painting, Black Again, by incorporating black people. Yet a white male disembodied arm with a gold watch also hovers in the far left corner, groping one of the subjects. This could be a thought about including in the painting. He's not just referencing Picasso. He's questioning and reinterpreting himself, Schneck said. Despite Braque's initial comment about La Demoiselle, he himself adopted a more angular approach to his paintings soon after. And by the 1920s, what initially caused disgust in Picasso's paintings was what saw it recast as a master. The writer and poet André Breton hailed the painting as revolutionary, convincing the French fashion designer and art collector Jacques Doucet to buy it. And in 1939, New York's Museum of Modern Art acquired it as a canonical piece. It still resides there today. More than a century on, Les Demoiselles d'Avignon remains so contentious that artists are still grappling with the themes within it. Proof, security of how one painting can be brought wildly despised and loved at the same time and can define a dramatic turning point in art history. Our next article was posted about 13 hours ago. It's titled, Portugal Breaks Hottest May Day Record as Europe Swelters in Heat Wave. Portugal has recorded a new highest temperature for May of 40.3 centigrade Celsius as countries in Western Europe grapple with sweltering hot weather. The temperature recorded in the central town of Moura on Wednesday bests Portugal's previous record of 40 degrees Celsius set in May of 2001. Ministers in France are meeting to assess the country's preparedness for heat waves, while tennis number one Jannik Sinner bowed out of the French Open after suffering from the heat. Meanwhile, Italian authorities issued a red heat wave alert for the capital, Rome, where it topped out at 32 degrees Celsius on Thursday. The heat wave is forecast to continue into the weekend, with Germany, Spain, and Switzerland having also faced unusually hot conditions. Parts of Portugal will peak at 35 degrees Celsius on Friday before the heat begins to recede, according to the nation's meteorological office. French Prime Minister Sébastien Lecornu chaired a ministerial meeting on Thursday afternoon to develop a readiness plan for extreme heat events, including combating forest fires and ensuring adequate water supplies over the summer. Baccalaureate exams, the French equivalent of A-levels, will continue during the heat waves, despite some schools having to shut their doors due to inhospitable temperatures inside. A primary school in Sousten in the Landes region will remain shut on Friday after it reached 53 degrees Celsius inside earlier in the week, a local official told French media. Education Minister Edouard Geoffrey told BFM TV that exam centers would be able to choose rooms with the most shade, adding that exams would go ahead simply because the students are prepared and there is also a schedule according to what they expect their results. The decision has attracted criticism from education unions and teachers, with one telling French radio of teachers forced to bring in their own fans. A survey by France's secondary school union found that nearly 78% of recorded temperature above 30 degrees Celsius this week and said it had received reports of teachers bringing in screwdrivers to pry open the windows. 17 departments of France and the north West as well as Paris are under an orange alert, indicating that people should be very vigilant about the weather. Temperatures reached 33 degrees Celsius in Paris on Thursday and are expected to top out at 34 on Saturday and Sunday. Police have announced measures to ease traffic in the capital until Saturday, including only allowing lower emission cars on roads and lowering speed limits. A single fare for the entire public transport network will be offered at the same time. At the French Open in Paris, Sinner appeared to be cruising to a victory before suddenly taking a turn for the worst. The Italian complained of dizziness and feeling lethargic before hitting a wall. "It was a tough spot to be in," he commented afterwards, but added, "Really, it was nothing against the heat, nothing against the weather. It was just me today, and that happens." Meanwhile, Italy's red alert in Rome, as well as Florence, Bologna, Brescia, and Turin, is the first of the year, warning of possible negative effects on the health of younger people and active people. Temperatures will climb to 35 degrees Celsius in Madrid over the weekend. Though the current spell does not officially qualify as a heat wave in Spain, the nation's meteorological office has said that the heat is that usually seen in July and August. The immediate cause of the heat wave is a, quote, heat dome, an area of high pressure that becomes stuck, trapping warm air underneath it. While it is difficult to link individual extreme weather events to climate change, a scientist says climate change makes heat waves more frequent and more intense. Over the last 30 years, Europe has been warming by 0.56 Celsius per decade, according to the Copernicus Climate Service, enough to make heat extremely dangerous and more severe. Our next article focuses on villas, cars, and cash. Italy seizes dead mafia mobsters' millions. Anti-mafia investigators in Italy have seized cash, companies, and other assets worth more than 200 million euro in an operation they say targeted the network of notorious late Sicilian mafia boss Matteo Messina Denaro. The fund is described as, quote, huge amounts of capital, end quote, by the financial police in Palermo, are said to be proceeds from over four decades of drug trafficking linked to the presumed former head of the Cosa Nostra group. Announcing the results in Sicily on Thursday, investigators released a video showing masked police officers, some in riot gear, barging down doors and scaling walls to raid a series of vast luxury villas surrounded by palm tree-lined lawns. Messina Denaro spent 3 years on the run until his arrest in 2023 as he left a clinic where he was being treated for cancer. He died in custody soon after. Whilst a fugitive, he had been sentenced to life for multiple murders, including the assassination of two anti-mafia prosecutors in 1992 in bomb attacks several weeks apart. He was also convicted of kidnapping and killing the 12-year-old son of a mafia man turned informer. After 2 years in captivity, the child was strangled and his body dissolved in acid so it could never be found. Police say their latest investigation follows some of the Cosa Nostra's money trail. It spanned multiple countries, including Spain and Switzerland, as well as the Cayman Islands. Three people have been arrested and eight firms identified, including real estate companies, said to be tied to these illicit funds. The head of the National Anti-Mafia Prosecutor's Office, Giovanni Malillo, called the operation strategically significant, not only because of the recovered cash, it also aims to prevent the reformation of a criminal organization that existed until a few years ago, he told a news conference. Seizing this wealth means continuing the disintegration process of the criminal group and the process of reestablishing structures capable of projecting the full intimidating power and economic social influence of the Cosa Nostra on a global scale. Italy's finance police say that their operation began with a report from Andorra on an Italian woman with significant financial resources. She turned out to be married to a drug trafficker said to have close ties to the Cosa Nostra and the Messina Denaro himself. The inquiry produced leads in several other countries. In total, police said more than 150 officers were involved in global operation, which ranged from using drones and thermal scanners to search for hidden stashes of cash to deploying IT experts to trace digital wallets and cryptocurrency. Italian media are calling the haul Denaro's drug trove, although the amount recovered is thought to only be a fraction of the vast wealth of this network, which has since been reinvesting all over the world. When trade soured, this American liqueur made move to Canada. Stephanie Introvato has a bit of a collection. Ever since taking her first sip of sourpuss at the age of 18, the legal drinking age in her home province of Quebec, she has been on the hunt to try every flavor of the brightly colored fruity liqueurs. From passionate fruit to coconut and watermelon, the 35-year-old counts herself, quote, very lucky to have acquired some hard-to-find bottles and merch. So when she learned that sourpuss, a very popular drink with Canadian university students, was actually American-made, she was shocked and concerned about where she would get her next bottle. Most Canadian provinces have been boycotting American-made liquor since the spring of 2025 as retaliation for the United States President Donald Trump's tariffs against the country. The boycott put Phillips Distilling, the family-owned maker of sourpuss based in Minnesota, into a very tight spot. They lost 70% of their Canadian business as a result, which CEO Andy England referred to as a disaster. Sales of sourpuss were the hardest hit, as Canada is by far its largest consumer. It forced Phillips Distilling to do something that they have never done before, move some production north of the border. The shift worked, with their products back on sale in stores across Canada. "We're just in a different place now," England told the BBC. "We produce and sell in Canada," he said. "We have, I think, convinced all of the provinces to take back some of our products, and we are on the road to recovery." U.S.-based liquor producers have all taken a financial hit since the trade war between the two countries heated up. But Phillips Distilling is one of the only ones yet to shift some production to Canada. A trade deal between the two countries remains elusive still. The U.S. has flagged the liquor sales ban as a main irritant in ongoing negotiations, while Prime Minister Mark Carney has said that the provinces may be willing to sell American alcohol again if tariffs on key Canadian sectors like automotives, metals, and lumber are lowered or lifted. Provinces first made the decision to ban the sale of the U.S. liquor in March of last year, starting with Ontario, whose liquor board is one of the largest wholesale purchasers of alcohol in the world and whose automotive sector has been hard hit by Trump's tariffs. Other major provinces soon started to follow, Quebec and British Columbia. As of May 2026, only two provinces out of 10 are still selling American alcohol, Alberta and Saskatchewan. In Canada, the alcohol sales are largely controlled by provincial governments, which operate boards that manage the import and sale of most wine and spirits, giving them broad authority over what is sold. Alberta and Saskatchewan have a fully privatized liquor retail system. For Phillips Distilling, the impact of the provincial liquor boycott was felt almost immediately due to the popularity sourpuss has in Canada. "If we sold 1,000 cases of sourpuss in the United States, I'd be surprised," England said, adding that he saw very much a Canadian brand due to how Canadians embraced it over the years. Because of its popularity, England said the company started exploring moving some of its production to Canada just weeks after provincial liquor boards began halting their orders. By October, as both Trump's tariffs and the provincial liquor ban showed no signs of ending, the company signed an agreement with a Montreal-based alcohol manufacturer named Station 22 to begin production. Canadian distributors across the country were excited and very appreciative that the company made the move, England said. But getting their products back on shelves took some time. Quebec agreed first, which he said helped facilitate conversation with other provinces. The return of sourpuss was celebrated by Introvato with an Instagram post. "Guess who's back?" She captured an image of four bottles of the raspberry flavor. "Oh, how I've missed you." Both England and Meredith Lilly, a professor of international economic policy at Carleton University in Ottawa, noted that it is easier for Phillips Distilling to shift production more north other than other companies who produce and are tied to certain geographic areas like Kentucky bourbon or California wine. Lilly added that because a big chunk of their business is Canadian, they have no risks of a reputational penalty in the United States for deciding to move their production. The decision to pull American liquor off the shelves by some premiers was a, quote, heat-of-the-moment response. She said that in this case brought an accidental positive, bringing more production to Canada. Quote, I don't think it was envisioned that the boycott would be in place as long as it has been, Lilly said. But whether the boycott will help Canada at the negotiating table is unclear. U.S. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick called it outrageous, insulting, and disrespectful. Lilly also captured that the decision to return U.S. alcohol back on the shelves ultimately rests with the provinces, not the Carney government, making it an unpredictable bargaining chip. Canada's federal government has retaliated against U.S. liquor in the past during Trump's first term when former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau imposed taxes on Kentucky bourbon as a way to put pressure on the Republican states after Trump slapped him levies on Canadian steel. Those tariffs were lifted less than a year later after both countries reached a deal. This time, however, the tariff dispute between Canada and the United States has endured, with two sides apparently no closer to reaching a deal. For years, as the last year has forced this company to rethink the way it does business, likely for the long term. China confirms it will buy 200 Boeing jets after Trump G summit. China has confirmed that it will buy 200 Boeing jets after U.S. President Donald Trump and the Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping met in Beijing last week. Under the deal, the U.S. will provide China with supply guarantees for aircraft engine parts and components, China's Commerce Ministry said on Wednesday. The two sides will also work towards an extension of the tariffs truce that they agreed in October and seek tariff cuts on $30 billion or more of goods, the ministry added. The announcement came as Xi was holding talks with Russia's President Vladimir Putin just days after the Trump visit. Trump's trip to China produced several pledges on trade between the two world's biggest powers and economies, including the Boeing purchase and increased access for American farmers to the Chinese market. Quote, we made a lot of great trade deals, including over 200 planes for Boeing, with a promise of 750 planes, which would be by far the largest order ever, Trump told journalists on Air Force One after leaving China on Friday. Boeing CEO Kelly Ortberg was part of the U.S. delegation that traveled with Trump to China. It also included Tesla boss Elon Musk and Jensen Huang, the CEO of AI chip giant NVIDIA. We had a very successful trip to China and accomplished our major goal of reopening the China market to orders for Boeing aircraft, Boeing said in a statement. This included an initial commitment for 200 aircraft, and we expect further commitments will follow after this initial tranche, it added. Officials from China and the United States reached an agreement in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, before a Trump G meeting in South Korea in October of 2025 that extended the tariff truce until November of this year. That deal included a reduction to U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods and a pause of Beijing's restrictions on exports of rare earth materials and magnets. Xi Jinping threw a grand welcome for Donald Trump on the first day of his visit that could reset ties between the rival superpowers. The military honor guard lined up outside the Great Hall of the People to welcome Trump, complete with a gun salute and a band playing the United States national anthem. The president paused twice to say hello to schoolchildren cheering with Chinese and American flags. As he shook hands with Xi, he leaned in to pat him on the arm in what appeared to be a gesture of warmth as he lavished praise on his host. You're a great leader, I say it to everybody, he declared in what appeared to be unscripted remarks. Later on his tour of the 15th century Temple of Heaven, he remarked to reporters that China was beautiful. At the banquet on Thursday night, he called the talks a cherished opportunity. It was a remarkable day given Trump built up his political brand by talking tough on China. We can't continue to allow China to rape our country, and that's what they're doing, he told a campaign rally in 2016. In 2020, he claimed China had ripped off the United States like no one ever has done before and described the COVID-19 pandemic as the Chinese virus. Before returning to power, he vowed to, quote, make China pay. At the height of the trade war last year, the two sides had levied tariffs that crossed 100% on each other. A fragile truce followed, but one of the main questions hanging over this place and this visit is whether that will last and what deal would it take place. Beijing put on a spectacle designed to flatter Trump ahead of any deal to prove China's doors open to guests. However, soon after talks began, state media published comments from Xi making clear the tensions over Taiwan could prove challenging. But the meticulous choreography was not just the benefit of Trump and the 30 CEOs who accompanied him. It was also a show of strength, which Beijing knows will be beamed live across the United States and the world. We are witnessing a historical change, said John DeLory, a senior fellow from the Center on U.S.-China Relationship at the Asia Society. I hesitate to put too much on this specific summit, but the inexorable rise of China to a place where it is legitimized, legitimately rivaling the United States, that is now happening before our eyes. Beijing is now the second world capital. President Xi has been eager to portray himself as a stable global leader in a number of worlds. World leaders, including those from the United States allies such as Canada, the United Kingdom, and Germany, have turned up eager to do a deal with Beijing. China's trade with the rest of the world has expanded since Trump's first term as it braced for exactly what he warned of, more tariffs. Last year, it flexed its economical and diplomatic muscle, responding to Trump with tit-for-tat tariffs and restricting the export of rare earth materials, essential for advanced manufacturing. Washington came to the table, and the tariffs were lowered. Xi will believe he has shown the United States and the world just how dependent they are on Chinese manufacturing and technology. China now makes a third of the world's goods, processing more than 90% of its rare earth minerals and produces around 60 to 80% of all solar panels, wind turbines, and electrical vehicles. While concerned about its records on human rights and its relationships with regimes like Moscow and Pyongyang persist, they seem to have been overshadowed as Trump shakes up the world order. Some would see this as a sign that the balance of power is shifting in Chinese direction. China will surely feel it has the upper hand in these talks as Xi faces a trumpet weekend by the war on Iran. The block Strait of Hormuz has rattled the global economy, and Trump is expecting to seek Beijing's help in order to open up the shipping corridor. Beijing and Tehran have a relationship dating back decades, and China is Iran's biggest trading partner. If Xi helps nudge Tehran toward the negotiable table, it may give him even some more leverage. Canadian man who allegedly sold lethal chemical will not be tried in the UK. Families in the UK say they are angry at the decision by prosecutors not to charge a Canadian man who is alleged to have sold a lethal chemical linked to the deaths of 73 British people. The father of one of those who died told the BBC that Kenneth Law has caused, quote, devastation, end quote, and that he wanted Law to face charges in the UK. Law is a former chef. He's expected to admit 14 counts of assisting suicide in Canada, where he appears in court in Ontario later on Friday. Prosecutors there say he marketed and sold lethal quantities of substances online, which he sent to about 1,200 people around the world. The Crown Prosecution Service, or the CPS, said the Canadian legal systems will take the losses of UK families into account. A letter from the CPS, seen by the BBC, said Law would not face charges in the UK because of legal complications. A letter from the CPS, seen by the BBC, said Law would not face charges in the UK because of legal complexities. David Parfait's 22-year-old son, Thomas, used the substance said to have been sold to him by Law. Tom was somebody who really saw the joy in life. He would find humor in the weirdest places. I often think about his laugh, Parfait said. Tom was a massive football fan, and he was a good footballer as well. I missed the opportunity to enjoy the 2026 World Cup with him. Parfait said, I had wanted Law to face charges in the UK. He really needed to face justice over there. He's called on the United States government to hold a public inquiry into the deaths. I think that a public inquiry is needed because we need action across multiple government departments. And unfortunately, we're not seeing that coordination and that understanding of how to address the problem today, he said. Fundamentally, the government is failing in its duty to protect life. The BBC has approached the Home Office for comment. Law is charged with 14 counts of assisting suicides in Canada and 14 counts of second-degree murder following his arrest in 2023. His capture followed a complex investigation by at least 11 law enforcement agencies and involved investigators from around a dozen countries, including the UK, Italy, and the United States. British detectives were initially investigating whether 88 deaths were linked to Law's chemical package, but in its letter to UK families, the CPS said it believed that 73 deaths could be linked to Law and that he was expected to accept sending 330 packages to the United States and to the UK. Here's an article from the world of sports. Suffering was less than my passion for tennis, says Rafael Nadal. Rafael Nadal had one of the greatest tennis careers the game has ever seen. He also spent nearly all of it in pain. Between his first French Open win in 2005 and his retirement in 2024, the Spaniard won 22 Grand Slam single titles, the second highest total of any man. He was part of the Big Three era, where he, Roger Federer, and Novak Djokovic carved up the sport's biggest prizes and thrilled fans. But a chronic foot injury meant Nadal had to find different ways to get through the matches, and let alone win them. In a new Netflix series, the 39-year-old opens up about the risks he took with his health in order to achieve greatness. I've had to make decisions about my health where you are on the borderline between right and wrong, Nadal said. But if I hadn't explored all of that, I probably would have had 10 fewer Grand Slams. I'm not saying one or two, I'm saying 10 or 12. This is the reality. In 2005, the long-haired, white, muscular teenage sensation announced himself to the world by winning the French Open in his first attempt, beating world number one Roger Federer in the same finals on his 19th birthday. He finished that season ranked second in the world, having won 11 single titles. However, it was also the year Nadal's injury struggles began in earnest. After breaking his left foot during his Madrid Open final victory, Nadal was diagnosed with a rare degenerative condition called Mueller-Weiss syndrome. Speaking to the BBC World Service's Sporting Witness program, Nadal said the foot injury was, quote, the origin of all of my problems. I had to stay over-positive, over-determined, always ready to try and find a solution to keep being competitive, and find a way to be on court again, he said. I went through a couple of times in my career a long process of injuries, but I think I was ready to accept that moment, to tolerate the frustration, and to keep working with hope and passion. The key was the suffering, was less than my passion and happiness for what I was doing. Dr. Ernest Massera, a specialist who treated the Spaniard's foot, said the condition was caused by an abnormal force that acted on an immature bone and attributed it to Nadal's intense training as a child. There were fears he would never play tennis again. On the suggestion of Massera, Nadal used a specialist insole to continue competing, but it meant that he lived in constant pain. Tennis became a race against time, said Nadal. Always having the doubt in my head of how long can I last with this foot. I never knew how long my career would last. I always thought maybe it's the last year, so there's no time to stop. The insole also contributed to other health problems in 2012. Nadal had to pull out of the London Olympics and the U.S. Open because of tendonitis in his left knee. My knee was destroyed. The tendon basically had a hole in it, Nadal said. Having to play with an insole throughout my entire career threw the rest of my body out of whack. In 2013, against the advice of a specialist doctor, Nadal decided to compete at the Hardcourt Indian Wells tournament. Using anesthetics to manage the pain in his knee, he won the tournament, went on to win a few further 9 tournaments that year, as well as winning the French and the U.S. Open in order to reclaim the world number one ranking from Novak Djokovic. However, he was using so many anti-inflammatories to manage his left knee that it caused other health issues. I have 2 perforations in my intestines, small perforations that can come from too many painkillers. At the 2022 French Open, the pain in Nadal's foot was so bad that he asked Dr. Angel Ruiz Quintora to put the sensory nerve to sleep with targeted anesthetic injections. So he had no feeling in his foot, and yet he went on to win a record 14th Roland Garros title, the last of his career. "He doesn't feel his foot, and he's winning this," said 7-time Grand Slam singles champion John McEnroe. What are you going to tell me next? He's going to play blindfold and he's going to win it also? Nadal was coached by his uncle Tony from the age of 3 with a tough love approach. Tony himself described denying Nadal water for the first hour of training sessions as a child to learn to suffer a bit, as well as encouraging his nephew to play on during a tournament as a child after he had broken his finger. "I won the tournament, but I had to wear a cast for a month," said Nadal. Describing the competitor's mentality, physio Rafael Memo said, "I think he likes to suffer with the intention of overcoming that suffering." At one point, however, the pressure on Nadal caused such compulsive behavior that he sought professional psychological help. If I didn't have a bottle of water in my hand, I couldn't swallow. I would choke on my own saliva," he explained. "I knew it was anxiety, but I couldn't find a solution. I tried to make myself believe that things were getting better. But really, well, I just couldn't. I didn't have time to go to a psychiatrist. He said it was probably due to all these injuries of high demand and constantly living with a fearing of stress. That process led him to add former Spanish world number one Carlos Moya to his coaching staff in December of 2016, which ultimately contributed to Tony moving on. The relationship with Tony on a professional level wasn't bad, but maybe I needed my head to hear a different message," Nadal explained. Between 2017 and retiring in 2024, the Spaniard won a further 8 Grand Slams. "I lived the last years of my life with a little more sense of freedom," he said. That seems to be all of the time that we have today. I hope you've enjoyed this reading of the BBC World News, and I look forward to reading for you at another time. Thank you so much for listening.